As-salamu alaykum. For those non-Muslims amongst us, that means peace be upon you, which is the staple Islamic greeting. It's good to be here. Thanks for coming along.
Phew.
Well, I guess you've all seen this. You might have seen this if you've come along. You might not. It's the advert that was put out for this. And really, this is kind of supposed to be a really broad overview of the dynamics of what's happening under the mantle of the war on terror. So it's going to be, I've got my new book on London bombings here, if you want to have a look at. And I've got a pile of books here, which are kind of like my exhibits, I guess. And I'm going to be brandishing them at you occasionally as I talk. So we're going to begin. The topic, the title was International Terrorism, The Secret History. And, well, I think let's begin with what's just happened recently. We had the Democrats taking control of Congress. And a lot of people have seen this as kind of like a very, very positive development. And I think to some extent it is. To some extent it's certainly a shift which to a different form of government, or a sign of that kind of shift taking place. But this kind of, the kind of sentiment that we're seeing in the news, that this is a really good thing, this means a drastic change in the way the United States is going to be doing things in terms of its foreign policy. This is really kind of linked to the fact that the war on terror is often perceived as a very new phenomenon that is linked to the Bush administration in particular. So it's linked to the rise to power of the neoconservatives. And in particular, the war on terror is widely perceived to be manifest, particularly in the post-9/11 war on Iraq. And secondarily, perhaps, the war in Afghanistan. But the focus really is very much on the war in Iraq. And as a result of that, the anti-war movement tends to focus on the Iraq issue as really the kind of be-all and end-all of its activities. So it tends to revolve around calling for the withdrawal of US and UK forces from Iraq. Now, I'm going to try and make this slightly more interactive. I'm not just going to bang on at you, because that tends to make people fall asleep, including me. So my first question for you is, I mean, who thinks that the Democrat vote will result in some kind of change? And if so, what kind of change do you think it will result in?
Not too loud.
Very superficial, make it slightly easier for Americans like me. But, I mean, just on a superficial level.
Yeah.
It's the people pulling the strings.
Yeah.
Will be the same.
Yeah.
No policy change at all. It might be detrimental, because it might be lulling people into a false sense of security.
Yeah.
Or yeah. Maybe
yeah, that's the concern that I have as well, actually. And I mean, here in the UK, obviously, there's a very similar kind of phenomenon, which is to link Iraq, British militarism, to New Labour and to Blair. And so there is this campaign to kind of topple Blair and to get rid of New Labour, but it doesn't really kind of recognise that getting rid of New Labour is not necessarily the solution, because this is really because there is a misdiagnosis of the problem, of the illness, I guess, if you want to use medical terminology. So my take, and the take that many of you will probably agree with, is that this is based on a very serious and entrenched misreading of the dynamic of US policy, and not just US policy, British policy and Western policy, which in fact is driven not by particular cliques, you know, a particular clique or faction, but is driven by core geostrategic and economic interests, which are related to an interlocking centres of military and corporate power. And these centres of power and the way they interact, that is really what drives policy. And if you have that perspective, then the truth is that the war on terror is not something new at all. In fact, it's a continuation and extension of Anglo-American imperialism in the post-Cold War period, designed to protect and perpetuate a very specific form of system. What we can call, for the moment, we can call it the global imperial system. And so if you want to understand what's actually happening today, we need to understand what we mean by the global imperial system. And if we wanted to do that in real depth, we could go all the way back to Columbus in 1492, but I don't want to do that because we'll be here for years and it won't really be very conducive. There's a lot of stuff to cover. So for the purpose of this talk, I'm going to focus on this kind of new period of history signified by the end of the Second World War. And as this is going to be a bit of a history, a lot of it's going to be historical. I'm not going to be focusing on 9/11 and 7/7 hugely in my talk. I think that will become clear as we talk. But there'll be ample time to discuss those issues in more detail in the Q&A session at the end. But let's begin with the state of the world after the Second World War. We had a situation where we just had the Second World War. Europe was devastated. We had a Stalinist Russia on the one side, which is fairly weak as well after the Second World War. Wasn't really looking to do very much except recuperate. We then had the most powerful nation was the United States, and this really was, the United States even before the Second World War was a rising power. But the Second World War put the United States in a position of fundamental global preeminence. And this was because they basically emerged very particularly unscathed. They had the advantage of a large landmass, huge resources, a vibrant economy, and a very, very strong military. And compared to everybody else, there was no parallel. So for the first time, the Second World War kind of opened the way for a very single hegemon. And that hadn't existed before, clearly. And I think in the world, if you look at world history, I don't think there's ever been a single global hegemon emerging in sight. And it's interesting to look at, because I'm going to throw a couple of documents at you as we go along. And there's one set of documents that was being produced by US policy planners who were with the State Department. And that what they had done, they'd set up these working groups before the end of the Second World War, because they were already planning what would happen if there was a victory. And they set up these working groups with the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, which, as most of you will know, is a very influential think tank. And these working groups, basically, they had experts, policy experts, planning how to reconstruct world order after the Second World War. What were the objectives? And there is a book by a guy, there's two professors in the United States called Lawrence Shoup and William Minter. The book is called Imperial Brain Trust, and the subtitle is The Council on Foreign Relations and U.S. Foreign Policy. It's actually out of print, but you can get it on print on demand. And it's a very, very insightful book. And the authors draw on this wealth of policy documents that came out at that time. And what the planners did, they identified what they described as a minimum world area, which comprised the entire Western Hemisphere, the former British Empire, and the Far East. And what they said was that, what these documents said was that economic control over these areas was, quote, essential for the security and economic prosperity of the United States and the entire Western Hemisphere. And what they said was that the only way that we could we can get this control is if we secure the limitation of any exercise of sovereignty by foreign nations that constitute a threat to this world area. And that's an interesting point, because imperialism, academically, is defined by the ability of one configuration of power, particularly the idea of a sovereign power, to actually influence the decisions of another sovereign power from outside. So this is a clearly kind of statement of imperial intent, the idea that they want to control what other sovereign states are doing in relation to this lucrative area. And what they said was that to achieve that, it's required the United States needs to have an integrated policy to achieve military and economic supremacy. And then they went on, they argued that on this basis, the concept of security interests should be extended to include the domination of these regions strategically necessary for world control. So this was a pretty candid set of papers. I mean, openly saying that we're talking about world control, we're talking about economic control, we're talking about military and economic supremacy. So it's, you probably wouldn't find a clearer statement of imperial intent at the dawn of this new era of international relations. So then there is a question mark over, so what was Britain doing at that time? Britain had its own empire, which was obviously on the decline by the middle of the 20th century. And while US policymakers were planning their own things, the British were also looking around and thinking, okay, well, you know, we've got a bit of a problem here. We've got our empire kind of unravelling. What are we going to do? And there was an interesting British top secret treasury document from 1950. So this is by the end of the Second World War. And it said, any general withdrawal by the United Kingdom on the political and military fronts would have an adverse effect on our economic position. So they were very worried about the implications of decolonization. Decolonization was this, the rollback of formal colonial control. So this was considered a serious problem. Indeed, it was on the basis of that that the British very carefully planned how they would administer the process of decolonization in order that they wouldn't fundamentally damage their access to the same resources that they already had in the era of formal control. There was a study by a guy called Cranford Pratt, who's a professor emeritus at University of Toronto, he's a historian. And he did a study of Africa and the decolonization of Africa under the Brits. And what he said was that all that the British planners who drew up the plans for decolonization advocated can be interpreted as, quote, shrewdly designed to protect and advance British economic and political interests in these changing circumstances. And he went on, the professor went on, he said, underlying decolonization, there was a plan to convert or reconvert formal into informal empire as the need arose. And this isn't actually, a lot of people think this might be, maybe there's a fringe area of history where some historians say this, but actually there's some very prominent historians who admit this. There's one guy from Oxford University, D.K. Fieldhouse, who is a professor in imperial history. He's a very well known, he's like a leader in his field. And he also says that the continuity of economic dependence of the colonies was the intended result of decolonialism. And I could go on bringing forth similar kinds of quotes from people who've studied the history on this. So how did they reconcile this? Well, there were two things. One of the things that is clear from the documents is that the Brits knew that their empire was in decline. So they knew they needed to have some way, some mechanism to keep some kind of control, but they knew that there was an unravelling that was inevitable. On the other hand, the United States knew that they were in a preeminent position, but at the same time, they were looking at the areas that used to be under the control of the Brits. And they were saying, well, you know, if we want to maintain our supremacy, we need to get control of those areas. And at that particular time, even though the British were facing a lot of problems, it was the Brits who had control over these areas. So the logical solution was a compromise. And the compromise was very simple. Britain would join the United States as kind of like a junior strategic partner under an American-dominated framework. And there is actually there's one document from the Foreign Office which says that. It actually says that the United States accepted the UK, thanks, as, quote, junior partner in an orbit of power predominantly under the American aegis. And that's very, very important because you get some people who kind of wonder about this special relationship between Bush and Blair being Bush's poodle. And some people think this is a new thing. But it's not a new thing. This is something which was actually agreed formally at the beginning of the construction of this particular world order. And that's hugely significant to understand the way the British and the American policies work. So we have this now, we have this new era of Anglo-American power. The United States on top, Britain in a kind of secondary level. So the question then was, how would they run this new order that they were planning on doing? And again, the documents are very, very revealing. There's documents from the Foreign Office, which are particularly insightful. Again, the British Treasury said in 1945, it said that we have to devise techniques for bringing influence to bear on other countries' internal decisions, especially those related to development. So again, the shift of policy was very important, because before that, policy was oriented, it was very formal, it was about controlling governments, maintaining troops in certain regions, and so on and so forth. But now it was changed. No, it was like, how do we, from outside, maintain influence on what's happening inside a country? And interestingly, it says very explicitly, how do we maintain control over another country's internal decisions? So look at the shift. It's not anymore that we have a British Empire which is now going to decide for you. It's no, you've got your own decisions. But how do we influence those decisions? So that's where the sphere of imperialism changes. And interestingly, one of the key issues is development. So there's an economic component there. And the document continues. It says, we should be able to exert a very great influence on the structure of that development. We could usefully begin with parts of the world in which we already have a great influence, the colonial empire, the Middle East and India. But there were other methods as well that were mentioned. Another document says it's important to maintain in friendly hands areas which contain or protect sources of metals, oils and other national resources, which contain strategic objectives or areas strategically located which contain a substantial industrial potential, blah, 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 it goes on and on. So again, there's another method here, which is maintaining a particular area that is considered to be of interest to you in friendly hands. So in other words, it's all about how to maintain dominance without doing it directly, using surrogates, influencing the decisions of those surrogates, and so on and so forth. Now, how did this play out on a worldwide scale? Again, this is a very, very important thing to understand. Quite consciously, the United States, Western Europe and Britain consciously looked at the globe and they made a decision on how they would organise and administer the world. And the United States, so they actually looked at the key areas. They looked at Asia, they looked at the Middle East, and they looked at Africa. And they said, okay, we don't want to fight over this because we've just emerged out of the Second World War and we've had enough fighting. Let's do this the nice way. And in some extent, really, it was really a case of the United States and Britain, to some extent, had a much more powerful say, because Western Europe at that time was completely devastated. So looking at Africa, for example, the United States advocated, quote, arrangements whereby a union of Western European nations would undertake jointly the economic development and exploitation of the colonial independent areas of Africa. And then there is another document about Asia, Southeast and South Asia, which says that the exploitation of these areas should contribute not only to the welfare of Asia, but also to the balance of world trade by developing sources of raw material for the United States and Europe. And finally, the Middle East, US planners in 1945, there is a document from the State Department which says, our petroleum policy towards the UK is predicated on a mutual recognition of a very extensive joint interest and upon control, at least for the moment, of the very great bulk of the free petroleum resources of the world. And it goes on to talk about a very special joint US-UK relationship on controlling Middle East oil. So that is basically the bulk of it. To some extent, Africa at that particular time was considered to be useful, but they gave joint access to Western Europe and also to some extent to Asia. But Asia had kind of basically was dominated by the United States and Britain. But in the Middle East in particular, the United States wanted to ensure that it and Britain had an almost exclusive monopoly on access in the Middle East. And the historical record actually bears that out, and to some extent explains even what's happening now. So then, obviously, the question is then, how does that relate to what happened afterwards with the Cold War? So I have another question for you that I prepared, which was one of the key doctrines that is used to explain the Cold War is containment theory. And containment theory basically says the idea that the Soviet Union was considered a real serious threat that was prepared to invade the United States. Well, to some extent, there were people who thought the USSR was ready to invade the United States as well. But generally, the idea was that they were ready to invade Western Europe. They're right on the border. And obviously, they were planning to expand communism internationally and basically establish a world empire. What I want to ask you is, do you think that the containment theory is accurate? And what do you think the Cold War was really about?
Just a cover-up for each of these so-called superpowers going and doing that and exploiting every part of the world that they could lay their hand or reach or manipulate. And this was just to fool the rest of the world.
Wow, we have some cynical people in the audience today. Anyway, what do we think of that? Do you think that's true?
I think basically, it's a fairly cozy relationship between two people who kind of agreed to their different turfs. And the threat of the other keeps people within each one more or less in line.
Yeah.
Sort of like a mafioso.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You control that street, we'll have this street. And
yeah.
We won't fight each other.
You raised your hand. God, that you raised.
Yeah. I'm Paul Stark, just to introduce myself from the notes on the board line. I think they're rival imperialist camps. Soviets wanted to expand, or at very least to hold what they had. As you saw in countries like Hungary, they turned nasty when people didn't want that.
Yeah.
And equally the Americans, particularly in Latin America, looked to expand their influence and to, as we've seen with the bullying of Cuba or Venezuela, they looked to hold what they have and gain more and more when they can.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, this really does... The cynicism, the extreme cynicism, is basically justified by the historical record. This always tends to be the case, I think, in history.
Sorry, do you mean by extreme cynicism that the Soviet Union was not a threat equal to the threat of America and Britain as you portray it?
Well, let's go. I'll give you my explanation of... I think I agree with the idea that the Cold War was really a case of there was a bipolar system where each power was using the threat of the other, or the alleged or the projected threat of the other, as a way of mobilizing its own populations, which were often for quite different interests. Often what they were mobilizing for was not actually about defending against this threat, but about things, quite different things. And I'm not going to talk about the USSR very much, because my interest...
No, but the truth is that the Cold War, if it had to start on one side, let's say the West, and on the other side the USSR, the imperialistic approach, desire, plans of USSR at that time were no less than that of the West. In other words, USSR left by itself would indeed have invaded the rest of Europe, no less the rest of Asia.
I have to disagree with that very strongly. If you actually study the Stalin's foreign policy in the Russian at the period of Russia, now the documents have come out from both the State Department and even from the old Soviet files, and they all pretty much make clear that Stalin was not interested in exporting communism.
You are taking the documents coming from under the regime of Stalin to be a non-biased, objective record of what Stalin wanted. I'm sorry, I wouldn't be the only person, but the majority of people who specialise on those documents would disagree with you.
That's not true.
It is true.
No.
They are not considered a primary, non-biased historical documents.
The documents that have come out from Stalin's files, they are eternal documents. There are some documents which were used for propaganda. There are others which are internal documents that were used only for access by Stalin and his closest aides. And those documents give a great deal of insight into what Stalin was thinking. And it's pretty much, if there's a consensus in the study of Stalin, at least, that Stalin was not interested in exporting communism. In fact, he was very annoyed when China came out on the scene, because, and he didn't want to export Soviet communism to China.
No, he wanted to rule. He was not interested in exporting. He was interested to expand, to dominate, and to rule.
Can you give me a source that will justify that? Because, I mean, I've been. Eastern European scholars don't agree with this idea.
What, that Stalin was not interested in ruling Eastern Europe as part of its empire?
He made a very, very concerted effort to consolidate Soviet control over Eastern Europe. But that's a very different thing to saying that he wanted to take over the world. Let's look at what the United States have to say about the Soviet threat. I mean, there's a lot of documents that have come out from the United States and from the British Foreign Office files, which show what our own policy planners were thinking. And a lot of what we were saying to the public at that time contradicts very much what politicians were actually saying behind the scenes. And this is very interesting, because one of the documents about the Soviet threat is, the canonical document was NSC 68, National Security Council Directive. And NSC 68 was basically the kind of landmark directive which outlined the contours of the Soviet threat, and was the first document really to put it all down in paper and to say this is what we need to do and why. And there's a very interesting section in that document. I have no doubt the Soviet Union was a threat, I don't agree with that at all. Not at all.
You haven't obviously lived under the yoke of the Soviet Union.
No, I mean, you can see my age. I haven't.
Exactly.
You know. But anyway, there's a section from NSC 68 which is worth quoting. It says, "Our overall policy at the present time may be described as one designed to foster a world environment in which the American system can survive and flourish. This broad intention embraces two subsidiary positions." And this is the one I'm focusing on. One is a policy which we would probably pursue even if there was no Soviet threat. That was the first indication from within the document itself that the actual policy being outlined was not necessarily linked to the reality of a threat. So disregarding whether there was a threat or not a threat, the document showed that perhaps the threat was actually something considered to be useful for justifying a policy that would have existed anyway. And in fact, this is kind of borne out by the way communism was described at the time. We have one guy, Richard Barnett, who used to work in the State Department. Can't remember his actual position. I did have it in my notes, but I don't have it here. But he actually said that the containment doctrine provided a very useful framework for demonizing threats not to national security, but rather to economic interests. And this is what he said. He said, "Even the word communist has been applied so liberally and so loosely to revolutionary or radical regimes that any government risks being characterized as communist if it adopts one or more of the following policies which the State Department finds distasteful." He said, 1, nationalization of private industry. 2, particularly foreign-owned corporations. 3, radical land reform. 4, autarkic trade policies or independent trade policies. 5, acceptance of Soviet or Chinese aid. 6, insistence upon following an anti-American or non-aligned foreign policy. And then 7 is others, other issues, miscellaneous issues. And interestingly, the guy who designed, and he was the guy who actually created the containment doctrine, George Kennan, who was chief of the policy planning unit in the State Department around this period, 1950s, he actually argued in the 70s, I think it was, I'm not sure, it's in my notes somewhere, in the 70s or 80s, he actually admitted that, quote, "the image of a Stalinist Russia poised and yearning to attack the West and deterred only by possession of atomic weapons was largely a creation of Western imagination." This is from the man who actually designed the containment doctrine. And since I wasn't going to focus very much on this issue, but since it came up, I'll give you the documents that I've come across from the British Foreign Office files, and some of these are available, books by this guy, Mark Curtis, who is a British historian. He used to work at the Royal Institute for International Affairs. And his first book is really his best book. I don't have it with me. It's called The Ambiguities of Power. It's published in 1995. It's the most comprehensive book on British foreign policy. I can strongly recommend it. But these are his other ones. And he's got another one out as well.
On people,
yeah, which is not bad. And a lot of these documents that I'm quoting, you can find there. And I've picked them up from bits and pieces, including from Mark's work. And including there's a couple of documents here that Mark has quoted. And these are all Foreign Office files. One of them is about he went through every single region, major region, and he assessed what was the Foreign Office analysis at that time, in the internal Foreign Office analysis of threat level. And what he found was that it was systematically contradicting the public line, which was that there was an imminent reality of actual interference, subversion, communist penetration, and so on and so forth. So if in the Middle East, for example, there's a Foreign Office paper in 1950 which said only three Middle Eastern countries are exposed to direct Soviet attack. And then it went on to illustrate that such an attack was basically inconceivable in all three cases for strategic reasons. Then it said, short of general war, an attack on Turkey is unlikely, owing to the Western guarantees which she enjoys, blah, blah, blah. As for Iran, the Soviet government must be aware that any attack on her would carry a grave risk of general war, and it's more likely that Soviet efforts will be confined to propaganda, diplomatic activity, and subversive activity. But there is no threat of invasion. Regarding Afghanistan, it said there's little danger of attack. Another document on the Middle East said, well, basically, that Arab states are mostly oriented towards the West in varying degrees, opposed to communism, and generally successful in minimizing or suppressing communist activity. But it said that the real threat is from ultra-nationalist elements that may exercise greater influence and form a greater threat to maintenance of a pro-Western orientation. And this is interesting because ultra-nationalism consistently surfaces in the declassified planning record as the real issue, not communism. Communism is often there, but nationalism is obviously is another issue which keeps coming up. So, for example, in Africa, around the same period, the State Department observed that, quote, black Africa is orientated towards the non-communist world. Communism has made no real progress in this area. To the contrary, nationalism constitutes the real force of the future in this area, blah, blah, blah. And basically the documents go on like that. I mean, even in Asia, there's George Kennan at that time, while he was head of the US policy planning staff, said, the problem is not one primarily of Russians, but of basic relations of Americans with Asiatics. And it carries on like that. Now, I think those documents would be consistent with both my perspective and your perspective, even if you hold the view that there was an actual intent on the part of the Soviet Union to expand and to take over the world. The documents would show that they had failed dismally and there was very little chance it was actually going to happen. So, to some extent, the reality of it, of what the Soviet Unions were intending, is not very important. It's obviously historically important, but it's not necessarily essential to understand what we were thinking at that time. And clearly, the declassified record shows that communism was not the primary mobilizing factor for the formulation of policy in these regions. And in fact, this is what Mark Curtis's argument is. His argument is that really, consistently, British and American foreign policy during the Cold War was about crushing nationalist movements for self-determination. And this is where we get to the interesting part.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, go on.
What's the situation about the conflict in the Americas in Vietnam and North and South Korea in terms of foreign policy?
Well, North and South Korea was clearly, there's evidence that the Soviet Union was consulted by the North Koreans. North Koreans went to them and spoke to them before they decided to invade South Korea. So there is some nominal evidence of a Soviet connection, but it's not clear precisely what precipitated what the same as really, I think with Vietnam it's slightly more clearer. Vietnam, it's very much established that the Soviet Union only got involved in Vietnam after the United States got involved. And that's simply a matter of looking at the date. It's very well known that the input of arms from the Soviet Union escalated after the United States was involved. And in fact, even if you look at that period, the amount of weaponry that was coming in, if you compare how much was coming in from the Soviet Union and China, compare it to how much was coming in from the Americans. The Americans were something like 10 times the amount that was coming in from that communist bloc. So if you want to understand the dynamics of what was happening in Vietnam, you have to look inside Vietnam and understand what was happening, what was it that was mobilizing Vietnamese population and motivating them, and what was it about that configuration that worried the Americans. I mean, again, I recommend Mark Curtis's book because he discusses this from a British perspective and looks at what the British were doing. And in fact, the British had a very, very interesting role in Vietnam. But we'll leave that for another time. So moving on to explain precisely what happened during the Cold War, there is a very secretive issue which is called Gladio. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Gladio. Does anyone know anything about Gladio?
Is it something to do with European groups and Western?
Yeah, stay behind. Gladio is very, very interesting and crucial. It's a very, very understudied area of history.
Gladio is also a weapon that Roman is the sword.
Well, you're Italian. You should know about Gladio.
So it comes from the word gladiator, then?
Yeah. Gladio is linked very much to Italy, but it's not just about Italy. There is a book that I have here called NATO Secret Armies. The guy, he's a Swiss guy, Daniel Ganser. This is an academic book. This is published by Frank Cass, which is a London-based academic publisher. He's also published about this issue in various peer-reviewed journals, and the newest edition is published by Routledge. Again, it's a very esteemed academic publisher. This is very, very well documented material. And basically, this is the phenomenon that Daniel Ganser brings to light. He's not the first one to have talked about this, but he's the first one to have done a systematic, comprehensive study. And he says that during the Cold War, the United States, the UK, and Western European governments and secret services, they participated in a very sophisticated, very secretive NATO-backed operation that was designed to engineer domestic terrorist attacks to be blamed on the Soviet Union within Western Europe. And basically, Ganser, he works at the Centre for Security Studies at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich. And basically, his book is based mostly on official sources, and those include, like, there are a couple of parliamentary inquiries in Europe into this phenomenon. So he looks at the transcripts of those inquiries. He also looks at, there's a very few secret documents that have been released because governments have been very, very, put a clamp down on these documents. But he looks at those. He also interviews various officials, government and intelligence officials, who were involved, and he knew about this operation. And the whole thing, basically, was actually hatched by, it wasn't hatched by the Americans, it was hatched by Prime Minister Winston Churchill in July 1940. He called for the establishment of a secret army to, quote, set Europe ablaze by assisting resistance movements and carrying out subversive operations in enemy-held territory. And the idea at the time was, well, what we want to do is, if there is a possibility that the Soviet Union overruns any of these Western European countries, we have these secret networks, these secret soldiers that are capable of moving into action and carrying out kind of like guerrilla warfare. That was actually the original kind of idea. But in time, it became something quite different, something quite sinister. Now, by October 1945, the British Chiefs of Staff and the Special Operations Branch of MI6, they basically directed the creation of this skeleton network that was capable of expansion either in war or to provide support to secret operations abroad. And then within the ensuing years, the United States got much more closely involved, and the MI6 began cooperating very closely with the CIA, and specifically with a department of the CIA called the Office of Policy Coordination. And this was organized right from the top of the White House. And what they did, they basically set up these very secretive secret armies across Western Europe. And there's one document that Ganser brings to light. This was a classified document. I'm going to read the whole thing out to you. It was authored by the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency. It's a field manual. It's actually a field manual that was given to these soldiers to train them. And this is what the manual says. It says, "There may be times when host country governments show passivity or indecision in the face of communist subversion, and according to the interpretation of the US Secret Services, do not react with sufficient effectiveness. US Army intelligence must have the means of launching special operations which will convince host country governments and public opinion of the reality of the insurgent danger. To reach this aim, US Army intelligence should seek to penetrate the insurgency by means of agents on special assignment with the task of forming special action groups among the most radical elements of the communist insurgency. In case this isn't possible, then what we should do is instrumentalize extreme leftist organizations for our own ends in order to achieve the above described targets. These operations should remain strictly secret. Only those persons acting against the uprisings shall know the involvement of the US Army, blah, blah, blah." Now, this document, the State Department officially says that this document is not authentic. They deny its authenticity. But the document was described as authentic and valid in its content by a man called Ray Klein, who was deputy director of the CIA under JFK, and he later became director of the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, which was the agency which published this field manual. And basically what it does, it instructs these secret soldiers to carry out acts of violence in times of peace, in Ganser's words, in order to blame them on the communists to create a situation of fear and alertness. Alternatively, instructs them to infiltrate the left wing and urge them to use violence. And this is a very, very disturbing development. And in fact, this emerged into officialdom in 1990, in August, when the whole thing was basically blown open in Italy by the Prime Minister of that time, Giulio Andreotti, basically admitted that Gladio existed. And within Italy, it was called Operation Gladio. I don't know if it's got a name across Western Europe, but in Italy, it was called Gladio. And he said that basically Gladio had been was exposed as a secret subsection of the Italian military intelligence services, and it had been responsible for domestic bombings that had been blamed on Italian communists. And they had a whole parliamentary inquiry which investigated this. And in fact, the EU, the European Union, actually, within 1 or 2 years, actually gave a resolution. It's in this book at the beginning, on the whole phenomenon. And it was very disturbing. There was a lot of stuff in the press around that time. But basically, Italy was not the only country where this happened. Ganser documents that there were a wave of terrorist attacks blamed on the Soviet Union, not only in Italy, but also in Spain, in Germany, in France, Turkey, Greece, and elsewhere, which were, in fact, organized by these secret networks. So this leads us to a pretty unsavory conclusion. It doesn't mean that many government officials didn't believe their own propaganda. Certainly many, many officials did. But what it does mean is that there were certainly, at certain high levels, there was a secret element within the Western intelligence community that was involved in deliberately inflating and embellishing the Soviet threat by literally any means possible. And this phenomenon, of course, raises very crucial questions about the role of international terrorism today. So the next section I want to talk about is, well, how do we theorize this and then apply that to our current state to learn something? And what I've done, I've divided it into three main points. And I've said that really what this means is that in the absence of a clear kind of mobilizing factor to justify the militarization of Western society at that particular time, military intelligence services, and not even just the CIA by itself. We're talking about very, very secretive subsections of intelligence services on the orders of a very small group of people within in a political level. Basically took it upon themselves to manufacture, both ideologically and operationally, in other words, in reality, a projected external threat of monolithic proportions. And so there's three tiers to it. First of all, we have the basis there's a predominance of a very specific type of interest in the expansion and consolidation of an Anglo-American dominated world system. The second prerequisite is the lack of a viable Soviet threat sufficient to legitimize the militarization that is required to pursue those policies. The third tier then is that when you have the absence of that, there is an ideological and an operational attempt to construct by these intelligence services and policymakers to construct a projected external threat consisting of this international dimension. And to some extent, there is a danger that that construction is not just ideological, that it actually takes a physical form. And that is the most disturbing thing for me, from my perspective. So the question is really, what happened after, when we had the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1990, by 1990 there was a collapse of the Soviet Union, clearly. So this entailed the collapse of, this three-tier structure then also collapsed, because then that self-reinforcing, mobilizing factor wasn't there. So for the first time, this opened the way. Without a doubt, the Soviet Union's existence prevented the United States from doing everything it wanted to do. The whole area of the world was closed off to Anglo-American interest. So for the first time, when the Soviet Union collapsed, this opened the way for the United States to project military power, even economic power, in these key regions that previously they couldn't even have imagined that. So in other words, it was almost like it was a whole new ball game. The world was our oyster in a way. But there was another problem. So although there was this amazing new opportunity, at the same time, there was this question of, well, how do we sustain that force projection? How do we justify it when the very entity that was preventing us from going there is now gone, because now we don't have a pretext, we don't have a justification? And it's in this context that Al-Qaeda plays a very crucial role. So my question to you at this point is, we hear a lot about Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda's everywhere. Al-Qaeda does this, Al-Qaeda does that. Al-Qaeda is behind some things. But interestingly, Al-Qaeda wasn't behind the London bombings. But what I want to put to you is, what do you think Al-Qaeda is? Do you think it does exist? If it does exist, what is it? Or does it not exist? If it doesn't exist, then what's happening?
It started with Al-Banna. Yes?
Yeah. To some extent. Not entirely.
And then apparently the Egyptians were executing those that stayed behind them, and the others fled to Saudi and the Taliban.
Yeah. To some extent,
and
yeah.
And we used them. Apparently leased them out to the CIA.
Yeah.
That's CIA creation. I don't know how true that is. Even if it was a CIA creation, I'm sure some people join it with the intention of fighting imperialism, but probably end up just getting used to CIA tools.
Yeah. There's a question.
According to Adam Curtis' programme, Power of Nightmares, the first time Al-Qaeda came out was when the Americans were trying to convict the first bomber of the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
And to convict them, they needed to prove a conspiracy, i.e. that he wasn't acting alone, because then they could use mafia laws to convict them. So they invented the network, Al-Qaeda, the base, to be the group that was part of the conspiracy that then allowed them to prosecute the guy's name on the dock for the first bombing. Ramsey is.
Yeah.
So, according to this theory in particular, it was something that was invented to provide a common enemy to Americans to feel safe that we're here, and therefore there's somebody else over there.
For those of you who aren't familiar, there is the the film is a BBC film called The Power of Nightmares, produced by this guy Adam Curtis. Does anyone else want to say anything?
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if you like cricket, but I kind of like the analogy of the President's 11. If, you know, if England are going to play abroad, they have to have a big-up team to oppose. And in the sense, it seems like the Al-Qaeda or the Al-Qaeda myth or whatever reality is there is that, at all, that its main role is to have a focus for kind of external threat. So it's kind of a
yeah. Yeah. Well, to some extent, there's been some very good points made, and I'm going to try and elaborate on that a little bit, because it's a fair point to raise the question about, does Al-Qaeda exist? Because I think the thing that Adam Curtis brought out very clearly was, and a number of other scholars have brought this out, that, first of all, the actual usage of Al-Qaeda by the people who supposedly involved with Al-Qaeda wasn't there. It was, in fact, it was by, in 1998 US embassy bombings, there was a witness on the stand, one of the conspirators, and it was like, are you a member of Al-Qaeda? And the guy was like, well, yes, I'm a member of that organization which you call Al-Qaeda. And in fact, Al-Qaeda had not been openly used by these people before that period of time. So the gentleman made a good point in that respect, and Adam Curtis raises that issue. So there's a question of, what is the existence of this group? And another journalist, Jason Burke, wrote a book called Al-Qaeda Casting a Shadow of Terror, where he says, he really raises questions about the organisational structure. I mean, if you go back a couple of years, the Brits and the Americans was describing Al-Qaeda as this monolithic, centralised, command and control, tentacles everywhere structure, you know, where you had one little guy there on the ground, on the phone to Bin Laden. It was kind of like a Marxist-Leninist. You know, these are the compadres of Bin Laden. It was a very, very kind of unsophisticated portrayal. And I think they've realised that, and they've moved away from that quite consciously, because it's been discredited in by subsequent research. So it's very clear that, I think, if you study the phenomenon, that there isn't much evidence to say that there is this very clear structure, this very clear organisation. It's very difficult to say that. On the other hand, my research suggests that there is a certain structure. When you look at the pattern of what Al-Qaeda is doing, as described conventionally, you say a group is Al-Qaeda, this is a group defined as Al-Qaeda, it's doing this. When you look at it, there seems to be a pattern there. I'll talk about that pattern in a minute. The first thing I want to mention here is who actually invented the word Al-Qaeda. And actually, Robin Cook, the late Robin Cook, has something to say about this. He wrote an article in The Guardian one day after the 7th July attacks, and he said, he's the only guy to have actually said this, by the way. He said that the term Al-Qaeda was invented by the CIA and referred literally to a database contained in a computer file, listing, quote, Robin Cook says, the thousands of Mujahideen who were recruited and trained with help from the CIA to defeat the Russians. And this is an extraordinary statement, because it says two things. Firstly, it says that an entity referred to as Al-Qaeda did actually exist to some extent. It existed since the Cold War. But the second point it makes clear is that this existence was not necessarily the same as a real-life organisation which actually exists out there in a very concrete sense, but rather its existence is in the form of a database of CIA Mujahideen recruits. And it suggests that this particular group of recruits could be linked to a very specific category of covert military intelligence operations. In that particular context, we're talking about people who were considered useful in Afghanistan to repel Soviet invasion. Now, this is very interesting, because the conventional wisdom admits that, yes, you know, we hooked up with Osama bin Laden during the Cold War, and we wanted to kick the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan, and that was it. After that, you know, bin Laden became our enemy, and he started fighting us, and now we've got the war on terror, and that's really it. And basically, this narrative is just not true. It just doesn't make any sense when you look at the facts. And there's a very, very good book. I wish I had the book. Don't have the book with me. There's a book by a guy called Richard Lebivier. He's currently chief editor at Radio France International, but he's actually Swiss. He's a Swiss television journalist. And the book is called Dollars for Terror. And it's based largely on interviews with European CIA officials. And one of the guys he interviewed was a CIA analyst. And this was after the Cold War, long after the Cold War. And the guy said to him, he was asking him about what was the CIA's policy towards Al-Qaeda. And the guy said, the policy of guiding the evolution of Islam and of helping them against our adversaries, i.e. Soviets, worked marvellously well in Afghanistan against the Red Army. Okay, we know that. The second statement is very important. He says, the same doctrines can still be used to destabilise what remains of Russian power and especially to counter the Chinese influence in Central Asia. Now, this statement is absolutely crucial. It says that there is a continuity, a conscious continuity of policy making. To not to say, let's forget bin Laden, let's just move away. It says, no, the doctrine of destabilization that we use in Afghanistan can still be used to destabilize what remains of Russian and Chinese power. So let's think about this geographically. Geographically, this has a very obvious implication. Russian and Chinese power means Eastern Europe, the Balkans, Central Asia. Those are the traditional spheres of influence. So if you wanted to test that hypothesis, you would look at those areas and say, okay, let's see. And that's basically what I did. Richard Lebivier didn't do that. And most of my research on 9/11, or the kind of stuff that interests me the most, is looking at Al-Qaeda's role in relation to Western military intelligence in the post-Cold War period. And I've got two bits here. This is my third book called The War on Truth. And that is kind of like my, I call it my magnus opus on Islamic strategy, because you can see it's quite fat. And I really, the writing's a bit small. And I'm telling you, when I look at this myself, I get bored out of my brain. So, you know, if you're interested in getting kind of the big lowdown, it's good. But this is kind of a bit easier to read. But that covers most of the stuff. And this is, I'm quite proud of this, because this is a paper, it's a peer-reviewed journal. This is very expensive. It's about $70 in the United States, but it's Research in Political Economy. It was published this year. It's contributions from a number of academics about 9/11. It's called The Hidden History of 9/11. It's a brilliant book. It talks about, I mean, I would say it's that because my article's in there as well, but my article in there, I mean, there's articles in there about all kinds of things, even about the World Trade Center collapse and all kinds of things. But my one in there is about Al-Qaeda. And I look at a couple of case studies in there, but if you take my work together, I've looked at Al-Qaeda in Azerbaijan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Algeria, Libya, the Philippines, and Chechnya. And that is basically, if you look at that regionally, you're looking at Central Asia, the Middle East, the Balkans, North Africa, the Asia-Pacific, and the Caucasus. So that's really, you're talking about the bulk of the world's major strategic regions. In every major strategic point in the world, Western power is symbiotically conjoined to Al-Qaeda, either financially or militarily or through intelligence connections. And it's not a conspiracy theory. It's absolutely hugely well documented. I don't know what you might think of conspiracy theory, but my interest is in understanding facts and the way they work and interpreting them. And just to give you a kind of one example, because we're running out of time, and I'm conscious of that, but give you one example just to give you an idea of the salience of this kind of research. I mean, let me think. There's a couple of examples I could give. There's one example that might be familiar to you. Is anyone aware of David Shaler?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Are you familiar with his whole story with Libya?
Yes.
To some extent. So, how many people are familiar with the Libya story and Al-Qaeda? Some of you. Well, it's an example. That just to give a brief lowdown, I think I'll give another example, but some of you are familiar. David Shaler worked for MI5. I don't agree with a lot of what Shaler says, but I think some of his story of of what happened in Libya is quite interesting. Basically, the thrust of what he said was that MI6 had a deep undercover operative in an al-Qaeda cell in Libya. And what they had done, they had paid about £100,000 to this cell to carry out an operation to assassinate Colonel Gaddafi. And the whole thing just went completely wrong. They actually ended up blowing up a civilian car and killing civilians. And the thrust of that, basically from a moral perspective, is simply that in 1996, there had already been the World Trade Center attack. There'd been an attack at the Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia, for example. They knew that al-Qaeda was a threat. So from that perspective, what were they doing, plying money to an al-Qaeda cell to carry out a covert operation, if al-Qaeda was in fact an enemy? I'm not suggesting that... I'm not quite sure how to... I mean, I think the question of al-Qaeda's relationship to the establishment is one that needs further research and further clarification. But that, to me, is a very interesting example of how the official narrative doesn't quite make sense of the actual facts. And it gets worse. I mean, the examples that I've discussed, if you look, for example, at Algeria, where you have a state which is fighting a civil war against a bunch of Islamic terrorists called, there's the GIA, the Armed Islamic Group, and there's the Salafist Group for Preaching and Combat, GSPC. These groups are, I mean, the conventional story is that these groups, after the 1991 elections were cancelled, basically formed as kind of, I don't know if you're familiar with Algeria. In 1991, there are democratic elections which the Islamic Party won, and the military moved in, really with tacit support from France, from the United States, from Britain, cancelled the elections. And since then, the whole country has plunged into civil war. And then you had the emergence of these terrorist groups, which are described as al-Qaeda affiliates. There's supposed to be interpenetration of mujahideen, of weapons, of funds, so on and so forth. The problem is that the Algerian government is saying that it's fighting its war against these terrorists. And they're saying that these terrorists are killing civilians, hundreds and thousands of them, and carrying out terrorist attacks in Algeria. Some of them apparently these terrorists also carried out an attack in France, the 1995 Paris metro bombings. Now, the problem with this story is there was a spate of very interesting reporting here, and also in France, in 97 and 98. Robert Fisk in The Independent, John Sweeney in The Observer, in particular, come to mind. But they actually got information from Algerian security service, former Algerian officers from the Algerian security services, who basically said that they had been working as part of a very clandestine operation which had penetrated these apparent Islamic terrorist groups and were actually carrying out terrorist attacks using these groups in order to justify the militarization of state policy and to justify essentially cracking down on political resistance. So this was a very, 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 very different picture. And in fact, this picture has now been corroborated more and more, especially in French. There's not a huge amount of literature in English, but in French, there's a burgeoning literature. In particular, there's a number of books published in France by a number of officers who worked in senior positions in the Algerian intelligence services. There was also a bunch of Foreign Office files that came out, I think it was either 1999 or year 2000, and there was this terrorist case against this guy, and it collapsed because the defence basically brought out all of this. They had asked the judge to get these Foreign Office files released, and when they came, it consisted of MI6, MI5, and even some State Department documents, all of them confirming that basically we've known for years what the Algerians have been doing and haven't done anything about it. But in fact, we've been doing a lot of things about it. We've been plying Algeria with financial aid. We've got very important oil and gas agreement with Algeria. We've been plying them with counter-terrorist assistance. Basically, we are complicit in what Algeria is doing. So I would suggest that the examples of Algeria and Libya, and they proliferate across regions, they give two ways of understanding the way we are relating to al-Qaeda today. The first is indirectly through a state intermediary. where a state has penetrated a certain network which has some kind of connection to Al-Qaeda, or alleged connection, or described in that way anyway, and we then have a connection to the state, either through financial, military, intelligence assistance, or there is a direct connection. The Libya example is a case where we actually had, through our own agents, connections on the ground. This is what happened in Bosnia and Kosovo and Macedonia, where we actually had direct liaisons with Al-Qaeda operatives which were flying in, for example, into Bosnia. But we won't go into that too much. I think that kind of gives a summary. In the Q&A session, maybe we can elaborate a bit more. But what does this then imply? If this is true, how do we interpret this in terms of understanding what's happening now under the guise of the war on terror? And my take is basically that you cannot any longer look at international terrorism in the form of Al-Qaeda as merely an enemy. On the contrary, Al-Qaeda has two particular roles, it seems to me. One is its existence, however it does exist, it's a questionable issue, legitimizes the wholesale militarization of Western societies, and is also subject, when possible, to Western control and manipulation in order to secure very specific strategic and economic interests, you know, in different theatres of operation. So throughout the post-Cold War period, Al-Qaeda has actually functioned as a vehicle of Western covert operations in the service of what I would argue are powerful corporate interests, particularly related to the monopolization of global energy resources. If you look closely at these regions, you find that most of the operations are about accessing regional oil and gas. Just as an example, if you look at Bosnia, Kosovo and Macedonia, and the manner in which, I mean, from 1992 to 1995, the Pentagon flew in about 1,000 Al-Qaeda Mujahideen, and this came to light from the Srebrenica inquiry into the genocide by the Dutch. There's an appendix to that based entirely on Dutch intelligence files, and it's a guy called Cees Weebs, who's a professor in Amsterdam. He actually wrote that appendix, and it details very clearly how the Pentagon actually did this quite directly. And it's pretty clear that doing that just destabilized Bosnia beyond all proportion. It actually it provoked a genocide without any doubt. And that kind of policy was replayed in Kosovo. And in 1999, there was an interesting statement made by Sir General Mike Jackson. At that time, he was commander of UN troops. And he said, "We will stay here for a very long time to guard the energy corridors that cross Macedonia." So even if we factor in that, yes, there may have been a humanitarian dimension at some point whatsoever, you cannot discount the crucial role of energy and the fundamental role of energy in motivating this operation. So if we want to make sense of that, using the three-tier approach that we developed with the Cold War, how do we apply that today? Well, it seems to me that Al-Qaeda's trajectory, the way it's functioned today in the post-Cold War period, conforms very much to that same kind of self-reinforcing structure. The first tier is much the same. You have a predominance of Anglo-American interests in the expansion and consolidation of a US-dominated capitalist world system. The second tier is, again, that there is a paucity of clearly identifiable regional threats that are sufficient to legitimize the militarization required to pursue those interests in those regions. And the third issue, then, very similar, is the ideological and operational construction by Western military intelligence services of a projected external threat consisting of Al-Qaeda-directed international terrorism. And this threat is used selectively and systematically, occasionally as a propaganda tool to justify certain policies, and also on the ground as a covert operations tool to destabilize specific regions. I've got a last section there, which was about why. The why of it. Why is this all going on? And I think that's a very important thing. We need to cover that. Because as we approach the turn of the new millennium, it became increasingly clear to policymakers that the global imperial system, as it has been constructed since the Second World War, was being plagued by multiple escalating global crises. which threaten within. I mean, it depends what perspective you come from. But my take is, I'm a cynic. I take a worst case scenario that within about 10 to 15 years, these crises are going to fundamentally destabilise the current structures of power. And I actually wrote an article about this, a very short article, a couple of months ago, and I'm going to draw from that. I'm going to repeat some of those things verbatim, so I apologise if you've read that article, you know what I'm going to say. But basically, I interviewed a guy who works with the Arlington Institute in the United States. The Arlington Institute is in Washington, and it was set up by James Woolsey, the former CIA director. And we had a meeting with him for various reasons to discuss cooperation, because they're very conservative, very establishment. And basically, he confirmed, almost to an even worse degree than I personally had feared, that the extent of the crises at this point is actually probably worse than I had imagined. And he talked about three things. He talked about oil, he talked about the economy, and he talked about the environment. And in terms of oil, I mean, I heard two of you discussing peak oil before. I thought I won't say anything now. I'll bring it up. And basically what he said is that he believes that the latest petroleum data indicates that global oil production probably peaked 2 years ago. And in fact, that was the conclusion I came to independently about a year ago. And so this is what I've written in my book. I actually thought it peaked a couple of years ago. And it's a number of experts concur on that. And I think there's a growing consensus amongst the oil industry. I'm talking about independent oil industry experts, not talking about just the oil companies. In fact, most of the oil companies are in denial about peak oil. Shell, for example, is busy drilling, looking for oil shale and looking for other types of conventional oil, and completely denying that there's a problem. BP is really doing the same thing. So most of the oil companies are in denial. But just to give you a couple of people who concur, there's one guy, Dr. Colin Campbell. He's one of the preeminent experts on oil depletion. He's got a centre in London. And he said, basically, we've come to the end of the first half of the oil age. And he had predicted in the late 1990s that world oil production would peak early 21st century. There's another guy, Kenneth Dayforus, who's a geologist. He's also a professor at Princeton, a professor emeritus at Princeton. He wrote a book. I don't have the name of the book, but he also pointed out. Sorry?
I wrote
Is, oh, okay. Is that the latest one? Because I'm sure he's written.
He might have done another one.
Yeah, I mean, but yeah, he's written a couple of books, I think. But Hubbard's Peak is one. And he pointed out, he believed that the occurrence of the peak occurred near the end of last year. So there's some variation, but there seems to be a concurrence. But for those of you who want to know, what the hell does it mean to peak? I keep talking about peak. What does it mean? Basically, it's simple. There's a physical amount of oil on the planet. And the theory of peaks suggests that basically when half of those global oil reserves are gone, then it becomes increasingly difficult to actually pump the oil out. Geophysically, technologically, it just becomes harder and harder to do it. It doesn't mean that there's no oil. It means that it's more difficult to do. But what that happens is, if you look at a graph of it, so there's the peak. And supply will start to slow down just because it's so difficult to get it, and it will get lower and lower and lower. And the problem is that consumption demands are getting higher. So the peak predicts that there's going to be a crisis, because as demand is lowering, consumption is increasing, and at a certain point it's just not going to meet. It's not going to happen. So there's going to be a point when consumption needs outweigh how much oil is actually coming out. So that's the idea, there's a crisis. And in fact, if you look at the petroleum data, most of the oil-producing countries have already peaked. It's pretty clear. Even the Saudis, for example. The Saudis recently announced that they've got billions of barrels of oil, and they keep insisting they've got so much. But in fact, they've consistently failed to meet their own quotas, and it's actually their production is decreasing over time. The second issue is... that I mentioned is the economy. And the guy I spoke to also said that he's spoken to leading US financial analysts who privately believe that a collapse of the global banking system could be imminent by 2008. And when he told me that, I was kind of like, I was a bit skeptical. I was like, yeah, right. But then I did a bit of research. And I know the global economy is very unstable, but I wasn't clear that how did he know it was going to happen in 2000? Why did he have that date? But there was an analysis by Gabriel Kolko, who's a very well-known historian. And he's at York University. And he did a whole article. It was in Counterpunch, the problems in the global economy. And this is what he said. He said, all the factors which make for crashes, he only said this earlier this year in July, excessive leverage, rising interest rates, etc., exist. Contradictions now rack the world's financial system, and a growing consensus now exists between those who endorse the financial system and those who oppose it, who believe that the status quo is both quite crisis-prone as well as immoral. And he says, if we are to believe the institutions and personalities at the forefront of the defence of capitalism, and we should, it may well be that we are on the verge of a serious crisis. And that scared the pants out of me, I'm telling you, when I read that. And finally, there's the third issue. I mean, there's other issues as well, but I've got those three. And the third issue is the environment. Most conventional estimates suggest that global kind of climate catastrophe isn't going to be due before another 30-odd years. But he argued that this was basically too optimistic. He said that the experts that he's in touch with have said that there could be an overlapping of several tipping points. A tipping point is really just a situation where, say you have, I'm not an expert on the environment, but say you have an example of the Arctic regions, and if they melt below a certain level, it becomes irreversible, the effect of that, and it can result in an irreversible chain of climatic events. And that's what a tipping point is. And there's a number of tipping points which apply to different areas of the climate. Okay, let me finish my point, which was on global warming, which, okay, some people don't believe in that. I think there's a very strong case to be made that the period of global warming we have today is unprecedented. But anyway, what I've got here, I've got a quote from... This guy I spoke to said that he believed, from the people he's spoken to, that if a number of tipping points were triggered simultaneously, that could trigger a series of very devastating climatic events within the next 10 to 15 years. And there's a number of... there was a couple of reports that came out very recently. There was one report, joint report, by the Institute for Public Policy Research here in the UK. They did it jointly with the Centre for American Progress in the US and the Australia Institute. And this came out last year, and they said that if average world temperature rises 2 degrees centigrade above the average world temperature prevailing in 1750 before the Industrial Revolution, then this would almost certainly trigger an irreversible chain of climatic disasters. And then they went on to kind of describe some of the possibilities that could happen. And finally, there was one final point, which was on the war front, was that actually the source also mentioned, this guy mentioned that that US generals had also repeatedly wargamed a prospective conflict with Iran on the request of President Bush. And they had consistently found that the simulations predicted, quote, an absolute nuclear disaster, unquote, from which no clear winner would emerge. And the generals thought the scenarios were so dismal that they strongly advised the administration to avoid such a war at all costs. But this guy said that the Bush administration was ignoring their fears. So that was another kind of potential crisis. So that's my summary of kind of escalating problems facing the world. And I think there is circumstantial evidence that suggests that even if we have doubts about whether some of these things are real or not real, or exaggerated or interpreted, there's no doubt that certain policymakers at very senior levels believe that this is what's happening and are taking drastic measures on that basis. There are reports from the Change Energy Task Force about oil depletion. There's a number of other reports that have come out from Dick Cheney in relation to an oil crisis. And some of these weren't originally meant for public consumption. They were meant only for the government. So there's clearly consciousness there. There have been Pentagon reports about the possibilities of climate change and its drastic effect for security policy. So there is certainly a huge amount of planning going on, which is conscious of the fact that the system itself is basically in decline. It's in drastic decline. So what's happening is not happening from this position of supreme power that you have the Americans sitting there going, ha, oh, we're going to take over everything. It's like, no. There is a very real fear that the system is unravelling in much the same way that the British Empire was unravelling, you know, about a century ago. So now there is this program of how do we maintain this structures of power in the face of this drastic decline? And this comes back to the question that you raised about why is there no real interest in alternative energies? And in fact, there is a lot of evidence that shows that the American government, the British government, are very clued up about the prospects of alternative energies and the viability of alternative energies. But they don't want to have alternative energies. And the reason they don't want alternative energies is because alternative energies imply a very different form of social organisation. If you take solar energy, if you take wind power, if you take even the other ideas, there's new research into different kinds of energy reactors using nuclear fission and all kinds of things. There's really cutting edge research, even in cold fusion and other kinds of things. And even in there's another area of physics called zero point energy. I know there's someone looking at you thinking, what are you talking about? You're talking about energy. But zero point energy physics is actually an area of physics which is, it's not many people are working on it, but it's an area that potentially holds a lot of answers. There's a wealth of research, and many, many energy experts have written studies about the viability of alternative energies. And what they imply is that really, in that state of
mind... Al Gore wrote a book about the viability of electric cars 10 years before his election.
Yeah, I saw that book, actually. I did see that book. I don't agree with everything Al Gore says, though. He talks about population problems and things like that, which I don't quite agree with. But he did actually, he said a couple of things about the environment, very interesting. So in summary, the very simple reason why there is a desire to maintain this very specific configuration of energy is because an alternative system entails the complete reorganization of the way things operate here. It would mean a different form of society. It would mean a way of organizing which is more decentralized. Energy would be more decentralized. Power structures would not be so centralized. Because at the moment, look at the way the power centers are organized. There is literally a military industrial complex, and it has a physical geography to it. It has a center in certain parts of the world. You have military bases centralized in areas of oil and gas, where there's huge areas of oil and gas. So there is a physical geography to this, and that centralization will not be needed. It will just make it completely irrelevant. And that's really that's really one of the huge fears. And that's why, in fact, there is a tendency, some scientists have complained of a tendency to actually suppress alternative energy research because it's just considered to be too subversive to the current state of affairs. So that's my take. My take ultimately is that we're living in the end point of an imperial system that has undergone various shifts over various times. The Second World War was one shift in that, and it wasn't the beginning of the imperial system. It was a certain shift, and we're now reaching another shift. And really, our position now is where is that shift going to go? Because this particular global imperial system, as it is structured, is dead. It's utterly dead. It's hollowed out. It's just going to take perhaps 20 to 30 years. 50 years maximum, absolute maximum, on a kind of looking at conservatively. I'm a cynic. I think it's going to take 10 to 15 years. We're looking at about half a century maximum before the system utterly, utterly dies. The question is, what is going to take its place? You know, there are disastrous scenarios about nuclear warfare, about mad climate change, about all these kind of things, energy collapse, and all the things you've heard about, and also doomsday scenarios saying that we're never going to be able to do anything about it. But we do have a choice. We have the option now to basically articulate and move forward, call for a new way of organising our societies, a way that is based on different values, a way that is based on justice, based on love, based on compassion, you know, based on a different way of viewing the objectives of human life, and which will organise our societies, our economies, our polities on a much more decentralized democratic basis. That's what we need to call for. Now, I don't know what that future looks like. I don't know. I don't have a communist manifesto, and I don't think anybody does, but we don't need one. What we need is the vision, because the human spirit has always gone through these tumultuous phases of history, and it's not. There's no time for the doom and gloom and for the kind of the ideas that, oh, we're all gonna just go to pot. Because if we take that perspective, we've already doomed ourselves. We've made the decision, and the decision we have to make is not. It's, the decision we have to make is to live. So my take is really, we've got an amazing opportunity at this time of crisis to actually move to something drastically better, and that's it.
Now, I wanted to ask you, I mean, about ways of getting to this place. So I wanted to ask you, what is your take on kind of like the status of 9/11 in history? Because, I mean, I'm quite new to this, but I've discovered that, or I understand that the 9/11 truth movement is saying that 9/11 is really the key issue to undermining that system that you were just talking about. Whereas I'm coming from the background of a left-wing background, where people, in as much as they discuss it at all, they say, well, even if it was true, it's just another false flag operation in a long line of false flag operations, as you've outlined.
Yeah.
So therefore, it's not really that significant. I just wonder what you thought about that.
Well, I don't. I mean, I can understand where the 9/11 Truth Movement is coming from, in the sense that they feel that they're right, in the sense that 9/11 clearly was a turning point in the way in which international relations is being structured. You know, there were shifts from the Cold War to the post-Cold War, and then 9/11. And 9/11 was basically the premise on which everything is being justified. So the theory is that if you show that 9/11 was not what it was, the way it's made out to be, or that 9/11 was basically our reading of 9/11 is drastically wrong, or it shows that there is, I mean, there's a range of interpretations. There's a maximalist position, which is there was absolute complicity, and the whole thing was organised by the Bush administration or elements of the state, blah blah. Then there is a range below that. And whatever you take, whatever position you take, I think there is a consensus position, which is that 9/11 is a story, is basically riddled with inconsistencies and just completely untrue. The question is, what does that mean? And I don't really feel that it's productive to just say it's all about 9/11 and that's it. Because what I find is that the 9/11 Truth Movement then fails to kind of recognise that 9/11 didn't happen in a vacuum. 9/11 was the result of a system. It wasn't just the result of Bush, and Bush sitting there saying, I'm going to push a button, you know, if you do hold to that view. 9/11 was the result of the... And in fact, even the rise of the Bush administration can be understood as the result of a dynamic process, the increasing criminalisation of the US state apparatus over time. And I think, to some extent, the Bush administration can be understood in that way. So to me, it's like you have to understand 9/11 in its context, in its historical, economic and political context. And that doesn't mean that you ignore 9/11, because on the other hand, there's an extreme on the left, which is like, 9/11 is not an issue, we don't want to know about 9/11. If you talk about 9/11, it's pointless. And interrogating 9/11 means that you're a mad conspiracy theorist, and just forget it. And let's talk about Iraq. Basically, that's the kind of traditional left position, which I also find very, very dissatisfying. And my feeling is that you need to interrogate all of these things together and see them as a whole and understand them as a whole. So it's not as simple as just saying 9/11 is the key issue. And everyone can cling on to an issue and say the environment is the key issue, or this is the key issue. These are all key issues, but we need to basically, it depends who you're talking to. Sometimes your audience will be more used that they want to hear about Iraq, you know, and sometimes your audience will want to hear about 9/11. It depends who you're talking. You need to see where people are coming from, and that's really the way I see it. But I think ultimately we need to be able to make people have a global understanding of things.
Just following on from what you were saying there about 9/11, it's not the only huge crime in the world ever, but because it has got the world's attention and has had the world's attention, it's its power as a key for many people around the world understand, having a better understanding of how the system and how the world really works, how the media really works, how the secret intelligence services really work, how the economy really works, all these things, you know, the kind of the subterfuge that states operate in. It's a really useful tool for introducing the way the world really works.
No, absolutely, I agree with that.
At the moment now, it's primarily that. It's not because it's the worst crime ever.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't. I don't think anyone's suggesting it's the worst crime ever. I don't think anyone's suggesting
And that's why I think it's really worthy of examination. It's a very powerful tool for us.
Yeah. Well, that's why I wrote two books about it.
Sure.
You know, because, I mean, it's important to. No, obviously.
I understand why the Nanobo Truth Movement is so passionate, because while it's not the be-all and end-all, it certainly is a very, very important.
Well, I mean, I'm really disappointed with the 9/11 Truth Movement. You know, I think the 9/11 Truth Movement has shot itself in the foot so many times because, well, basically, they only see 9/11 and they don't do what you're doing, what you said. They don't relate it to everything.
I agree.
You know, I mean, I just. It's just about the whole purpose of I mean, a lot of the. I don't know, look. The US 9/11 Truth Movement is different to the British 9/11 Truth Movement. I've had a better experience in the United States. My experience in the UK has not been wonderful. It's been really a case of people obsessed with shouting that 9/11 is an inside job. And unless you shout that, and that's my experience, unless I shout that from the top of my voice, from the rooftops, then I am possibly a double agent. That's basically the feeling I get. From, you know, maybe I am, I haven't realised, you know, but I mean, obviously that doesn't represent everybody in the truth of it in the UK at all, but the sense I've got from a lot of people in the movement, and it's a very diverse movement, so it would also be wrong of me to characterise the whole movement in that way, because that's only, I would say, certain people that I've come across a lot, but that's the feeling I get, you know, and I think the movement needs to make an effort to grapple with multiple issues and bring them in, you know, to relate 9/11 to these issues. Because a lot of people just don't see the relevance. A lot of people kind of think, this is the perspective. You look at you go to the anti-war protesters, they'll just be like, no, but it's not important. It's not important, you know. It's 3,000 Americans dead. What about the hundreds and thousands of Iraqis dead? And then they'll stop talking to you. So you have to find a way of,
But what he said, the whole world is focused on the 9/11 thing. Surely the exposure of 9/11 would bring about enough of a shift in the whole world's thinking, so that there may be a new philosophy in the world, whereas people stop taking media and authorities so seriously.
Why only 9/11?
Well, no, because it will be a sort of like an opening. It starts. It's sort of like the one point that rips the fabric open. 9/11 got me studying history, which I never did before. I've studied so much.
Well,
But where does it go? If all you can do is say 9/11 is an inside job, where do you go from there? What does 9/11 mean?
If it is exposed.
Why did 9/11 happen? What does it mean? Do you know what I mean? What I'm saying is, it's not just about the World Trade Center was demolished by explosives. I have proven it. You know what I mean? It's like,
it's one simple thing that's
where do you go from there?
Spread like a virus throughout the world.
No, it's not.
And suddenly
it's not.
People
they made it like that. They blew it out of.
What happened with JFK?
That's the whole idea.
If you take JFK, right? People thought that exposing JFK would be the ultimate solution to, I don't know, active, you know, world consciousness. It didn't happen. There needs to be an integrated life. You know, human life is an integrated thing, and we need to approach it in an integrated way. Because 9/11 didn't happen just because it didn't happen out of the blue. It happened as a result of the way the system operates. And 9/11 was also one particularly bad example, the worst example of a phenomenon that is actually very common to the way U.S. power has operated. Not just U.S. power. Western European colonial imperial power,
human nature. We
need to inform people
we as having
humanity as having a slave nature in needing to a hierarchy and authority to bow down to, and to accept mindlessly things that people on television tell us and governments.
Anyway, I think we better move. He's going to tell me to stop.
Yes, I would like to, if you can take two more questions.
This, yeah, okay. There's, this guy's been had his hand up for ages, so sorry. Go on. No, no, no. He's had it up for ages, and I haven't remembered to ask him.
Shane Collins from Land of the Green Party. Been fascinated by what you've been saying. I think for me, probably the most interesting thing is suggestions that the CIA and various other groups have kept on a relationship with Al-Qaeda or governments of the Mujahideen to continue on in Central Asia. That's been fascinating. The nub of it, oil crisis and environment crisis. We've been, the Green Party, we've obviously been looking at this for some time. So it's really a question of what do you feel about using climate, I mean, using carbon quotas as a way of dealing with the recession that will follow peak oil and the possibility of further exacerbating the climate?
Well, I mean, it's going to get pretty bad if we carry on as we're carrying on now without any kind of attempt to reconfigure our societies. We won't have much choice. Do you know what I mean? It's going to be a case of there's not going to be enough energy to go around, and that's the situation we're looking at. And we may not feel it immediately, but we will start to feel it very quickly. And when we do, it's going to be terrible. And I think partly that is why we have this sudden rush since 9/11 of emergency legislation, some of which isn't even directly connected to terrorism. I mean, here we've got the Civil Contingencies Bill, which gives huge draconian powers to the government to do what it wants to anybody, basically in a civil emergency. And President Bush just signed, when he signed the Military Commissions Act, he also signed the Public Disorder Act, I thought it was called.
They're building concentration camps.
Yeah, that's going on as well.
With asphyxiation gas.
Yeah.
Actually using this is true.
So the government, rather than thinking about the kind of things that the Green Party is thinking about, and thinking about, okay, what do we do? Policy, what do we do as a society in that kind of, in a situation? And we have to think as well, we have to think beyond just quotas. I mean, quotas is, like you said, an emergency kind of, it's an emergency thing that would need to be done to stop a kind of mad rush of chaos. But we need to think long term as well, how are we going to live? So in that context, the question of what the government is doing, putting through these kind of legislations, is they're not interested in even looking at these things. They're looking at a situation of social crisis, and they're thinking how they're going to control that. There's no desire whatsoever to think seriously about reducing CO2 emissions. There's just no serious desire. If you look at the climate change minister that we've appointed, he's got no money. His office is just there for it, because the government knows that the public is thinking about these issues and they want to show they're doing something. So I think this is important issues, and we really need to have a public debate. We need to somehow bring these issues into a public debate and raise awareness of these issues. You wanted to say something.
Yeah. Maybe a final question, maybe a quick conclusion. At the last section of your speech, you mentioned about if the human beings got to survive on this planet, certain values have to be changed. What I'm wondering, where do you think these values will come from?
Well, as a Muslim, I believe in God, and I believe that there should be, that you need to have humanistic values. And as a Muslim, I take my values from my religion. Also, as a Muslim, I believe that you can't go around forcing your values on anybody else. My view is that human beings have to recognize that this particular industrial mechanic reductionist value system associated with capitalism is fundamentally dysfunctional. It's just not a very functional way of living. And we need a different value system. And I don't know how that's going to develop. I mean, I think people will do what they want. They will communicate with each other, and we'll talk about it, and we'll have dialogue, and we'll say, what should we do? How should we organize ourselves? And that's the way it has to do. It has to be something fluid, because ultimately, especially in Islam, there's no compulsion to religion. If there is faith, faith has to come from within, has to come from, otherwise it doesn't mean anything. There's no moral thing. So ultimately, it's a question of where, you know, humans have to make their own choice what we do. But ultimately, the choice has to be, if you're going to get anywhere, it has to be something which takes, it takes compassion as a bedrock. And I don't see how that's going to happen unless you somehow ground those values in reality. You don't see them as some disembodied thing that you just, okay, if you want to do it, it's good. But you have to have, in some way, you have to view the world in a way which integrates those values. So, I mean, my feeling is that there needs to be a move towards a more spiritual way of looking at things. You know, but people might disagree with me, but I think that's the way it has to go.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the speaker.
Thank you.